Sunstone presents Faithful versus Fair, Philosophies, Methodology, and Mormon History, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
I'm Alan Smith, here to introduce our two speakers for this session. But before I do that, I'd like to announce that a gentleman by the name of Gregory Wainless has left a credit card with at the dialogue table. So, Gregory, if you're in here or if any of you know Gregory, he's got a credit card there and needs to pick that up. This session is styled Faithful versus Fair, Philosophies, Methodology, and Mormon History. Presenting main paper will be Bruce Neil Westergren. Bruce was born in Denver, Colorado, moved to Chicago at the age of 12. His first experience as a detective, and I guess this was preliminary to his detective work in the field of history, came while working as a special investigator in Chicago for Montgomery Ward's corporate theft unit. This was before he left on a mission in 1974, mission for the LDS Church, I presume. After his return, he again commenced service at Montgomery Ward's corporate theft unit. He graduated with a BA in history in 1980. From there, he has moved into the field of lawyers and things legal. He's worked as a paralegal and an investigator for the firm of Taylor & Taylor in Spanish Fork, Utah. Also, he's done work as paralegal, legal secretary work at small finance companies doing credit checking and skip tracing. He renewed graduate studies at BYU in 1983, has worked as a research assistant for the History Department in the Charles Redd Center for Western Histories from 1984 through 1986. And from May of 1986 through the end of July, while completing his MA in History at BYU, he's worked as a full-time temporary as a paralegal for the firm of Bishop Harmson and Springmeyer in Salt Lake City. He is currently employed by Lynn Foster, a Salt Lake City attorney. While his thesis area is in the history of technology, his graduate minor was church history and doctrine. He is currently the author of two articles, has presented several papers, and is now working on his first two books. Responding to Bruce's paper will be Melvin Smith, whom most of you probably know as the former director of Utah State Historical Society, a former president of the Mormon History Association, and is presently director of the Idaho State Historical Society. He has published articles in Dialogue and Utah Historical Quarterly. We'll hear from Bruce and then Melvin. If time permits, we'll entertain questions from the audience. Thanks, Alan. Over the course of the last 25 years, a number of articles have appeared in various places discussing the philosophy of Mormon history. Some of these have criticized the writing of church history as it has been done in the past and proposed new models for its study. Others have argued that there can be no study of the Mormon past apart from an attitude of faith. Some have wondered if any model is possible at all, and a few have attacked traditional ways of writing Mormon history without offering new strategies for approaching the LDS past. Now, this paper has two specific purposes. First, to highlight some of the major philosophical models proposed for the study of Mormon history, and second, to critique these views and offer a different model in their place. The articles which are cited here are those which propose a specific approach to the study of the Mormon past. Publications which are largely historiographical in nature and do not propose any new paradigms have been omitted for the purposes of this paper. One of the earliest articles on this particular subject was The Search for Truth and Meaning in Mormon History, written by Leonard J. Arrington. He examined the LDS record-keeping and historical writing as a whole, breaking it down into four periods. According to Arrington, the first period began in 1830, when Oliver Cowdery and John Whitmer were appointed to be official church record keepers and historians. The second phase started in 1838, when Joseph Smith and some of his associates began to compile the documentary work now known as the History of Joseph Smith, or the History of the Church. This work was published serially, beginning in the Times and Seasons in 1842 and in the Millennial Star from 1853 through 1863. Under the editorial guidance of B.H. Roberts, it was later published as a 7-volume History of the Church. Arrington's third stage began around the turn of the century and was due primarily to the efforts of assistant church historian Andrew Jensen. Jensen's work was threefold in nature. First, he prepared biographies of the founders and officers of the church, many of which were published in the 4-volume LDS Biographical Encyclopedia. Jensen was also responsible for the encyclopedic history of the church, as well as for starting the day-by-day collection of articles and other materials of church associated with church history, now known as the Journal History. The fourth phase of Arrington's article came with the creation of synthetic histories. This category includes such works as Tullidge's Life of Brigham Young, Bancroft's History of Utah, and B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History of the Church. These histories, Arrington felt, helped set the tone for all subsequent writing in LDS history. Largely documentary and narrative in nature, they did not concentrate on the analysis of events and the people who made them happen. Rather, they simply observed the event itself, leaving out the motives of the people involved. This makes sense considering that at the time these books were written, personal records, diaries, journals, letters, and related items, and minutes of meetings were generally not available to the researcher. Instead, the working historian was forced to rely on the institutional records of the church, since they were readily accessible through the church historian's office. Arrington then went on to examine some of the biases that seem to have affected our impressions of Mormon history, as well as our interpretation and writing. The first he labeled as the theological marionette bias. Here the reader would be left with the impression that the First Presidency and other church officials are nothing more than puppets whose strings are pulled by the Lord. When he moves the strings, the brethren act accordingly. This, Arrington feels, denies the human factors at work in church history and tends to strip church leaders of their personalities and their humanity. Certainly they were great men and outstanding spiritual leaders, but we cannot ignore the flesh and blood side of their careers. Next is the patriarchal bias. This is the idea that men hold all the important decision-making positions in the church and are therefore responsible for everything that happens. This interpretation minimizes the role of women in LDS history, thus ignoring the significance of Martha Hughes Cannon, Aurelia Spencer Rogers, Eliza R. Snow, and others. Next is the solid achievement bias, which measures the accomplishments of people in strictly material terms. There is also the centrifugal bias, which assumes that all important influences and forces in church history started at the center of the institution and then radiated outward. Finally, there is the unanimity bias, which sees the entire panorama of Mormon history taking place in an atmosphere of cooperation, concord, and consensus. Just parenthetically, 2 years ago I had a class in economic history of the Western United States, and the professor taught it, we started out concentrating on Utah, and he said if there was one statue that he could erect that he thought would be representative of Mormon interpersonal relations,
during the territorial period in Utah, it would be of two of the brethren standing over an irrigation ditch and swinging at each other with shovels. Also, in going back to Arrington's patriarchal bias, I think that tends to work in reverse, too, here in Utah. Most of my job experience has been clerical, and outside of the state of Utah, I have never had a problem obtaining a clerical position. But it is almost impossible for a guy to obtain a clerical position. You'd be amazed at how many female chauvinists there are in the state of Utah. Going back to Arrington, his article ended with a call for an honest approach to studying Mormon history and proposed some alternative philosophical models for research, emphasizing Wilhelm Dilthey's model. Once again, parenthetically, Dilthey's model, he believed that there was such a thing as an objective man, someone that you could look at and view and that you could come up with a history for and that everybody would agree on. When I read his works, my impression was that he was trying to move history into a scientific discipline where he had rules of procedure, rules of research, and the results would come out the same every time and everybody would agree on it. So you'd have universal laws governing people. Of course, this was the same approach that Karl Popper took too, but there are some serious objections to that. Arrington believed that it was now time to confront our total past, failures as well as achievements, weaknesses as well as strengths, individual derelictions as well as heroism and self-sacrifice. He felt that such an honest look would do the most to strengthen the testimonies of the saints than all the faith-promoting stories ever told. One more anecdote before I go on. When I was in high school in Chicago, there were a group of about a half a dozen students where I attended, and we used to get together in one specific classroom every night after school. School got out at 3:10, and my mom knew that I'd never be home before 6 because all we did was Bible bash and get into arguments and things like that. We had all sorts of different religions represented. A couple Jewish friends of mine. We had a number of Pentecostals, some Roman Catholics, you name it. But on this one particular occasion, this one Jewish friend of mine was asked why she thought it was so important to keep the Old Testament as part of the canon of Scripture. This Protestant friend argued that, you know, with Christ, the Old Testament was done away, so why bother with it anymore? And my Jewish friend thought about it for a minute, and she said, well, look at it this way. She says, in the Old Testament tells us many things. First of all, it reveals to us how God deals with his chosen people here on the earth, whether they are under the covenant or not under the covenant. It still teaches us how God reveals himself to his children. And she said, secondly, it's important as a historical work because it shows us how good men can remain good and maintain a proper relationship with the Lord. It shows us how good men can go sour, like David did and Solomon. It also teaches us how rotten men can become righteous and how you can have an ambivalent person who does good some days, and if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed the next day, he does rotten things. So there are a lot of historical importance in the Old Testament. And this, I think, is what Arrington was getting at, that we do need, while we need to emphasize the faithful character and nature of our church leaders and other members of the church, nevertheless, we need to realize that they do have their human side as well. And the Old Testament is definitely the archetype of that approach to historical writing. Richard L. Bushman in 1969 contributed further to this discussion with the appearance of his now classic article published in Dialogue entitled Faithful History. just summarizing his article, he spent the first half of his essay explaining exactly what it was that historians did and why so many interpretations of history appear on the shelves year after year, many of them repeating either themselves or each other. History, Bushman claimed, was made by historians. Facts were not fixed in a predetermined form, merely awaiting discovery and description. Historians had to select and mold their material. Indeed, the historian cannot help sculpturing the past. Simply because the records contain so many facts all heaped together without recognizable shape. Historians were forced, therefore, to select certain facts and form them into a convincing story. As a result, scholars came up with differing accounts of the same event. This should not be taken to mean, Bushman hastened to add, that historical materials were completely plastic. Facts cannot be forced into just any form at all. Some statements about the past can definitely be proven wrong. However, the historian had much more interpretive leeway than a casual reading of historical texts might suggest. The historian's sense of relevance, his or her assumptions about human motivation and social causation, and the moral readers were meant to draw from the story all influenced the outcome. He also went on to describe other obstacles which presented themselves in trying to reconstruct the facts. First, each generation will reinterpret the record, the historical record, in light of what it believes is important. Bushman believed that this was good. Each new generation could frame new questions to be asked of the sources and perhaps even ask some of the old questions in a new light. There was also difficulty in being the survivability of the records as far as document preservation goes. Of course, this is an extremely difficult problem when you're dealing with ancient works such as the Old Testament. Since Mormon historians also have been trained for the most part at secular institutions, they can't help bringing middle-class American intellectual values to the typewriter with them. And this can be a definite disadvantage if you're trying to write an article or a book on religion-state attitudes in ancient Assyria or something like that, because middle-class American values just do not translate over time and space. Now, in spite of these problems and in spite of bias due to secular training, Bushman felt that the scriptures provide models of history which ought to be examined. He placed special emphasis on the Book of Mormon. From this, he derived a number of possible approaches to the past. Just going through these briefly, the first of his models regards history as the story of constant tension between man and God, which once again is illustrated in the Old Testament. Another model, related to the first, divides all of human history into dispensations. These dispensations are times when the gospel in its fullness has been on the earth, separated by periods of apostasy and darkness. Examples of authors, LDS authors, who have taken this approach include Milton R. Hunter, James L. Barker, Talmadge, of course, and definitely Hugh Nibley. Another theme Bushman drew from the scriptures was the providential guidance of people and nations. According to this idea, the Lord acts directly in the affairs of men and nations to bring about his purposes on the earth. Since God's ultimate goal is the salvation and the eternal life of man, everything he does is therefore directed to that end. Milton Bachman's book, American Religions and the Rise of Mormonism, is a classic of this particular type of writing. The last model that Bushman discussed as being conducted through the power and was, mankind being conducted through the Spirit and the light of Christ as a necessary precondition for human effort and progress. According to this concept, everyone in history who has sought truth, no matter what their endeavor, would find help and guidance through inspiration from the Lord. Bushman concluded by stressing the fact that he was not calling for a quote-unquote orthodox approach to Mormon history. Rather, he was simply indicating ways that our faith can provide models when studying LDS history. Other articles that have been contributed since Bushman's 1969 publication include an article by Dr. Richard Paul entitled God and Man in History, where he saw the historic process as a continuous interaction between divine intervention and man's free agency. At issue with Dr. Paul was Paul Edwards in his 1973 article entitled The Irony of Mormon History. Edwards discussed a paradox he saw in Mormon historians. By and large, he found that those who have written about and discussed the LDS past have tried to derive their approach to history from their faith and not from their training as historians. And I think this is true, especially in Bushman's article, where he polled examples of approaches to, or theoretical models of approaches to history from the Book of Mormon. In this case, you don't have a history explaining religious events, but rather you are developing a theology which will then go on to explain history. And you wind up trying to hammer the round peg into the square hole. As a result, Edwards went on, the reader has been left with a theology of history, not a philosophy of history. And Edwards went on to disagree with this approach and once again called for a more honest and open approach. In 1974, Robert Flanders wrote an article entitled Some Reflections on the New Mormon History. The New Mormon History, which is, I have a hard time dealing with that term, because while it may be new in terms of using it to study Mormon history, it's the same old historical rules that have been around for some time. It's just that now we're starting to examine our past in the light of recent developments in historical research. Flanders drew the distinction between the New Mormon history and the Old Mormon history by saying that the New Mormon history was beginning to abandon the old polemics, neither attacking nor defending the faith. It was a shift away from an evangelical style toward a humanistic interest, a quest for identity rather than a quest for authority. The New Mormon history, he felt, was based in religious concerns, but was at the same time different from and a necessary precursor to critical religious studies yet to be written. Okay, going on, Flanders discussed contributions to the what he termed as the New Mormon history. Examples such as Leonard Arrington's Great Basin Kingdom, Flanders' Nauvoo Kingdom on the Mississippi, and Klaus Hansen's Quest for Empire. Finally, Flanders also saw an ecumenical element which allowed for a greater dialogue between Salt Lake City Mormons and RLDS historians, as well as other outside groups as well. All of these trends, Flanders felt, were encouraging moves toward a more authentic history of the Mormon movement as a whole. However, in a recent Sunstone article entitled No Higher Ground, David Bone took exactly the opposite view, criticizing that there was any such thing as a new Mormon history. He based his argument on the idea that no research into the past could be truly objective. Bone asserted that historians themselves could not be objective and neutral concerning their subject matter, and that the historical record itself offers no independent and objective ground on which historical explanations can be verified. Because of the incompleteness of the record and the difficulties of interpreting it, Bone believed that historians could not help fleshing out the past according to their own preconceived notions. He did not see the New Mormon history as any real improvement over the Old Mormon history, and called for Mormon scholars to investigate alternative models once again. One more story. I apologize for this, but I think it illustrates the point. Long, long time ago, and in a galaxy far, far away, had a friend of mine, roommate, a number of years ago. He joined the church when he was in the Army, stationed at Fort Lewis, just outside of Seattle, and he was taking night classes from the University of Washington. This one particular quarter, he was taking a class in philosophy, and the professor of the class was a thoroughgoing existentialist. The professor did not believe that there was any existence anywhere in the universe except what he projected from his own mind. One of the other students in the class happened to be a full-time policeman and came to class right after he got off duty, so he was still in uniform and carrying his sidearm. And they got into an argument one night in class over objective versus subjective reality. And this policeman finally raised his hand and he said, "Let me see if I understand you right, Professor. You're saying then that since the entire world around us is nothing but a projection of your own mind, that you therefore are personally responsible for all of the crime, all of the poverty, all of the sickness, the hunger, the horrors of war, and all the other mean, bad rottenness that goes on in the world?" And the professor thought for a minute, and he says, "Yes, I would have to say that that's a logical extension and a fair conclusion of my philosophy." Well, the policeman pulled his sidearm out of his holster, cocked it, and pointed it at the professor, and he said, "Great, I'm going to end all of the world's problems right now." And the professor passed out cold on the floor. But anyway, the idea that there is an objective reality is important. History is the past itself. What historians do is to study the past, and I think there is too much of a tendency to merge the two, and we get lost somehow, mixing ourselves too much in the past. Historians are supposed to be time travelers, not residents in the past. Now, in going through the literature on the philosophies of Mormon history, several trends become apparent. First, there are those such as Bushman and Paul who try to develop a philosophy of history from their religious beliefs. Next, there are those who criticize the old school, which uncritically venerated the past, and instead they ask for a more honest and open approach in studying Mormon history, but propose no particular methods for doing so. Flanders, of course, falls into this category. Then there are also those who not only ask for a more open approach, but propose various alternative models for understanding and working with the past, such as Edwards and Arrington. Finally, there are those, such as David Bone, who do not believe the past exists outside of the historian's mind, once again the professor at the University of Washington, and therefore say that no model is adequate for explaining Mormon history. While some of the proposed models, particularly Alexander's, are useful in studying Mormon history, there is one major shortcoming in all of them. Any philosophy of history, underline any, whether sacred or secular, invariably dictates in advance the conclusions that will be reached even before the source materials are consulted. Any evidence which does not agree with the model being applied tends to get kicked into the scrap heap since it threatens the researcher's preconceived notions. In suggesting alternative models for examining the Mormon past, the new Mormon historian runs the same risk as the old venerative school of ignoring anything that does not agree with current working assumptions, whether they're his or someone else's. Historical research carried on in this fashion is not only unfair to the subject under study, it is also unfair to the reader and unfaithful to the researcher's professional training. What is needed, therefore, is not a model that tells the researcher in advance how history should have happened, but rather analytical tools which will allow historians to discover and analyze the recoverable past. We must realize that the past runs on a logic of its own. And our job as a historian is to somehow get inside that past, to work our way into the minds, the attitudes, the social and economic situations that the people that we are studying faced at the time that they lived. Either saints or sinners, where none may exist. Such a methodology should allow people to have their weaknesses without celebrating them at the expense of their strengths. It should also lead the researcher to the sources necessary to create the most balanced picture of the best of the past possible without interpolating, extrapolating, or interjecting too much of the historian's own biases into the work. Finally, it should help the reader to understand the people being studied in the context of their own time, which we've already discussed, and the limitations of their circumstances. Now, this particular approach or this particular methodology I'm going to label as the detective model for obvious reasons. I'm afraid I've spent too much time hanging around attorneys. The detective model has several distinctive elements. First, it can contain no preconceived theories or fundamental assumptions which would predict the outcome of the study beforehand. The detective has two guides at the start of an investigation: the rules of logic and evidence. The absence of preconceived theories is absolutely vital to the successful solution of a crime. For example, if a detective enters the scene of a homicide convinced ahead of time that all murders were committed by left-handed redheads with mother fixations and suffering from trauma induced by sibling rivalry, the chances are he's not going to get very far with his investigation. He'll always be looking for clues that don't exist. And if you're like Senator Joe McCarthy, no offense to his fans that may be in the room, a commie under every rock. Instead, he must approach each case with a fresh mind, ready for whatever evidence the scene of the crime and the witnesses might yield. Then, if the culprit is a left-handed redhead with a mother fixation and suffering from trauma induced by sibling rivalry, he can go ahead and make the arrest. Now, the second thing, in the second major point in this model, is the review of the crime scene itself. Physical evidence such as fingerprints, cigar or cigarette ashes, damaged furniture and personal belongings, and footprints, among other things, all play a role in helping the investigator reconstruct the events and circumstances surrounding the crime. Some clues are obvious, some are not. Sometimes help may be necessary from outside sources. In any event, the reconstruction of the scene is the first major step in the solution of the crime. It can say a great deal about the people who were there, what they did, how they did it, and sometimes even why. One friend of mine once made the remark that the only difference between a historian and a detective was the sort of hat they wore, because they're both going after the same thing, a reconstruction of the past. Unlike the detective, however, the historian is not always so lucky in this regard. In historical research, the scene may be hundreds or even thousands of years old. Even the historian, however, may be able to get help from outside experts, archaeologists, linguists, anthropologists, and material culture specialists. Letters, journals, diaries, photographs, drawings, paintings, newspapers, and a plethora of other items are all necessary for recreating the backdrop of the past. While the historian and the detective might not be able to recreate the scene perfectly, at least it is possible to get a good approximation and to establish a case beyond a reasonable doubt. Then there's the isolation of the suspects and the witnesses, which is also important. This means determining who was at or near the scene at the time the crime was committed, what they heard, what they saw, and what they did. Detectives can usually interview their subjects directly. The historian's witnesses have usually been dead for some time, which makes it much safer. Once the people have been identified, though, it then becomes a matter of patiently searching for any statements or testimony they may have left behind. This once again takes the researcher back to the sources as close as possible to the event itself. This leads us to the problem of the reliability of the witnesses. Questions of collusion, conspiracy, jealousy, hatred, or other emotional biases, the physical ability of the witnesses to actually be able to see and hear what they claim happened, and their overall competence mentally or professionally must all be weighed in evaluating statements made by those present, either by a detective or by a historian. Determining the reliability of the witnesses can also aid in reducing the complexity and contradictions involved in historical research. by concentrating on the people most closely associated with the events being analyzed and eliminating secondhand or hearsay reports coming well after the fact, historians and detectives both can be relatively certain that they are building a reliable core of facts about an event in the past. Last, and possibly most importantly, the question of consistency over time. Detectives can interview people any number of times for any number of reasons. First, investigators need to check the accuracy and the reliability of the witnesses and the suspects and the statements that they've made. The important factor here, of course, is to see that repeated statements concerning a specific event are never word-for-word reiterations. And here, just let me insert the example of the prophet Joseph Smith and his account of the first vision. He was all by himself in the grove that day, and during his lifetime, he gave at least 8 major accounts. There are some others that are starting to turn up. But you will notice, particularly in Milton Bachman's book on Joseph Smith's first vision and his the re-release of Eyewitnesses of the Restoration, and in Paul Chessman's book, Keystone Mormonism, for that matter, that if you create a harmony or dissect each of the testimonies that Joseph gave, that they are consistent, but they are never congruent. They are never word-for-word reproductions. But Joseph is telling the same story, emphasizing different points, and using different phraseology to perhaps reach different audiences or other things, but he never repeats himself exactly. And that would lead any detective to conclude that that event really happened. Now, if there are word-for-word, word-perfect reiterations, it's a sure bet, a darn sure bet, that whoever made the statement is lying. Consistency is the key, once again, and not congruency. By making repeated interviews, detectives can also get new details that may have been overlooked, forgotten, or didn't even seem important the last time around, allowing for a more complete picture of the case in question. Historians often have the edge here since they can examine the witnesses and the participants over a longer period of time than a detective can. Besides studying journals, diaries, letters, and memos, historians can also make use of later accounts as well, recollections, oral histories, reminiscences, and memoirs. After the evidence has been assembled, the problem of reconstruction begins. The researcher is faced with the task of trying to make a coherent picture appear from a morass of index cards. Sometimes the pieces dovetail nicely, sometimes there are conflicts between sources or even within the same source, which need to be resolved. If so, it means a search for further testimony. In this stage, a lack of preconceived notions or assumptions is particularly important. Once again, the only guide can be the evidence at hand, coupled with the rules of logic. Once the data is assembled and a coherent picture begins to emerge, there is one final hurdle that confronts detective and historian alike. Is the case that's being developed provable beyond a reasonable doubt? Before claims can be made or charges filed, the investigator's logic must be solid, the witnesses and their testimonies unimpeachable, and the evidence sound, physical evidence. If not, the opposing attorney will blow the case out of the water, and I've been unfortunate to have that happen to me once. Even the best of detective work can fail if the case isn't presented properly with every loophole covered. In summary, the detective method, as opposed to a philosophy of history, which reasons from assumptions which might or might not be true and which may or may not be provable, allows the researcher to reconstruct a more balanced, even-handed picture of the past. It does not dictate conclusions in advance, as historical philosophies do. Instead, it gives the researchers a set of tools for discovering the past instead of imposing their own preconceptions on the sources. Now, I should emphasize very strongly at this point that the detective model cannot guarantee a completely objective analysis of the past. There is no model that can. Since not all of the past is recoverable because of document loss or destruction or failure to keep records in the first place, the biases of the witnesses, of the participants. We have to contend with all of these limitations when we're doing historical research. But the most we can hope for is balance and fairness. And I honestly believe that the detective method offers the best means for reaching that goal. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. I approach this task with some apprehension and feel that some way or other I ought to call on William Shakespeare to justify my being here once again debating the issue of faithful history. A couple of years ago, I presented a paper or submitted a manuscript to Sunstone to be published, and they said they thought that was my Midsummer Night's Dream, I guess, and they informed me that they thought that the topic had been all covered well already and needed no further discussion, so I referred to it then as Love's Labor Lost. And when I was asked to come down here again and talk about this, a critique of paper on it, I decided that maybe, again, it was much ado about nothing. And I decided that I ought to be a little more optimistic and decided that, anyway, all's well that ends well. So hopefully we'll get there today. Now, Mr. Westergren has proclaimed his objectives in this paper to be, one, to highlight some of the major philosophical models for the study of Mormon history, two, to critique these views, and three, to offer a different model in their place. I would say he has succeeded in doing that very well. And I must say that I received his paper and plenty of time to read it, and he sent me a second copy to make sure it was that I received the one he was going to deliver. And then he got here and changed it just a little on me, but I appreciate getting it on time. His focus has been on the theme of writing good history, useful, objective Mormon history. He has cited major bellwethers among the flock of faithful Mormon historians and has isolated important elements in their perspectives on writing Mormon history. I am not surprised that the name of Melvin T. Smith does not lead all the lists. In fact, that it did not appear at all. But then I never wanted to be a wether of any kind, bell or otherwise. Properly, Mr. Westergren credits Leonard Arrington, Richard Bushman, and Richard Paul Edwards, Robert Flanders, and David Bone, perhaps, and Thomas Alexander as being major spokesmen on the writing of Mormon history, or more particularly, Mormon historical methodology. Nor do I argue with his summary statements. I think they're pretty good. The recent histories by each of these authorities reflect the qualities Westergren has noted for each of them. He argues also that in spite of their claims of having a solution for the problem of writing faithful history, none of them has been free of ideological bias. I agree. I do not believe, however, that bias in history is fatal, to its value, nor even to its reader. Nor do I believe that all biases are equal, for obviously some biases are more equal than others. I recommend these authors for their scholarship and commend these authors for their scholarship and for their courage in putting their ideas in print. As Job of old lamented, "Oh, that mine adversary would write a book." While it is tempting always to take a shot at an author and probably quite beneficial for the history profession as a whole, I shall today be more cautious. Let me add that I feel that the new Mormon historians especially are doing much to broaden and enhance the reader's comprehension of Mormon history, and I applaud that kind of scholarship. Now, Mr. Westergren next proceeds to present us a bias-free model for the writing of objective Mormon history, which he calls the detective model. It is an approach which emphasizes logic and evidence. I believe his purposes and processes are as sound as others he has cited, and a lot simpler. For some scholars, his methods may prove very useful. At least, it all seems logical to me from the evidence he has presented us. But I do not believe our author comes any closer to a solution of the dilemmas he has addressed today than did his predecessors. Why? Because, in my opinion, the problem is not in methodology at all, but in the nature of the evidence that historians who believe and write about their religions must deal with. In the nature of the evidence that they must deal with. For example, proving the truth of what someone says about a cow can be substantiated by credible witnesses. However, even here, the evidence is reviewed by a judge or a jury who pronounce a decision. And to say that judges and juries have never been fooled belabors the obvious. And that with mere human evidence on purely mundane. In religious history, the evidence can be colored, or since the 1978 revelation, I should say clouded, because a religious person's reality includes facts, truths, evidence inscrutable to mortal senses or logic. For example, and I was pleased to see you insert this about Joseph Smith's first vision, how do you detect the truth or fact of Joseph Smith's divine mission? By one, his testimony; two, circumstantially through the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon; three, in the Book of Mormon itself; or four, from other claimants with testimonies. One can make an interesting case for the court on this issue. Jack West Sr. did just that several decades ago with his trial of the Stick of Joseph. The mock jury awarded him an affirmative verdict. But did that prove anything about Joseph's divine mission, since all of these actions, evidences, substance, are merely human that he was using, and merely history, namely a record of human activity? West's logic and evidence did not detect divinity, rather history only. Believers, by definition, acknowledge a source of light, of fact, of knowledge, or of truth that is transcendent. They argue openly that God or the divine has witnessed and does witness to them. Through God's help, they detect the facts or truth. The meaningful evidence for believing is their spiritual experience primarily, and not intangible evidences or logic. It may be well to note that problems do exist for many who claim spiritual witnesses, but who in fact are using only logic in rather circumlocuted fashions. Logic always starts with a presumption of some kind. From that presumption, a conclusion of fact is deduced, and that conclusion is in turn used to confirm the veracity of the original presumption. For example, God rules in the world through his prophets. That's a presumption. Brigham Young was God's prophet. Therefore, the Mormons were destined to go to the tops of the mountains. Now, the reverse of that. Because the Mormons ended up in Utah, which somebody says E-U-T-A, which is supposed to mean tops of the mountains in Ute, Brigham Young surely was inspired. Therefore, God obviously rules in the world. Still, nothing spiritual has been proven that was not originally presumed. It is this kind of religious certainty that is the bias of the believing Mormon writing in history. Bias can reside and sometimes does reside in methodology, but methodology deals only with careful scholarship. Obviously, methodology is important, but is not an answer to religious biases. Now, is there an answer? I don't know for sure, but I have suggested before two possibilities and their utility for believing Mormon historians. One step is to acknowledge that history, as a human discipline, deals only with human beings and their evidence. It cannot discover God. Let's take the historical example of Joseph Smith's claim to having the gold plates. Let's assume that Joseph Smith did tell the truth. We have his record to look at, and even if we do not challenge his facts, the historian reads only Joseph's witness of history, namely, "Mankind, I tell you, God spoke to me." In this historical evidence, we cannot detect with history tools God's witnessing that Joseph claimed. And to make the point more precisely, the historical record shows us that Joseph told three men, Oliver Cowdery, David Whitner, and Martin Harris, that he received the gold plates from an angel from which he translated the Book of Mormon. That was Joseph's own historical witness to them. Later, these three men, according to the historical records, also saw the same angel and the gold plates. The angel told them that Joseph had indeed translated the Book of Mormon by the gift and power of God. The angel's witness would have been a divine one. The point to be seen here is that there was clearly a difference between Joseph's historical human testimony or record of the event and the angel's divine manifestation. Whether or not this all happened is not the point. The critical issue is the distinction between Joseph's record, both personal and written, which was a human witness, that is only a historic report, even though Joseph himself claimed himself to be a God's prophet. It appears Joseph knew and noted the difference between the quality, value, and meaning of his own record and that of the angel. You will recall from his own history that he told his mother, subsequent to the angel's visitation to the three men, that he, Joseph, no longer had to carry by himself alone the burden of God's witness, for these three men knew God's witness even as he knew it. And they knew not through Joseph's claim, which he had given them before, but through the angel's witness. So Joseph saw that distinction. From the historian's seat, Joseph's claims can be scrutinized by historical methodology. The supposed divine witness by the angel cannot, because the witness and the evidence of God's involvement is not contained in the historical record, but rather in the witnessing itself. While the witnessing may have been divine, the record by itself is only history. Stated simply, one cannot look to history for divine evidence. History is only human. Which brings me to my second point. Since believing Mormon historians must, by definition, live in two worlds, believing and history, the world of history, the human records, and the world of faith, the divine witnessing, they cannot avoid in their minds and in their very beings a kind of dual world. Often this is not a comfortable world to live in. In fact, usually it is not. There are, of course, several options for believing historians, perhaps none wholly satisfactory. One, they can disown the facts of history when they conflict with their faith and beliefs. Trust in the Lord, as it were. Two, they can deny their faith, lose their beliefs, trust in the arm of flesh, some may say. Or three, and this is what I recommend, they can take the facts they have discovered from human sources, history, and the facts they know or find meaning from in their faith, and begin their own theological struggles for synthesis and understanding. To do this, people must use what they know and value from both sources. The exercise goes something like this. Okay, I have learned these facts from history, good, objective, new Mormon history, or detective model history, or faithful history, and these facts suggest possible explanations about life, why things happen, what a human being is, where values are to be found, and so forth. On the other hand, from my faith I know or believe certain things about life and about my relationship to God, a higher power, or whatever we term the divine. So how do I put these two worlds together to make some kind of sense? That process is a theological exercise. Man, woman, people trying to understand God and explain his divine will. This exercise is inevitable. It is our nature to engage in it, I believe. The key to remember is not to mix the processes. Use history to get historical data. Use faith to get God's witness or divine data, if you will. Then, after the data are in mind or in hand, try your synthesis. These theological exercises will be ongoing, since learning from history is continuous, as are those values derived from one's faith. Each person becomes, in fact, a theologian, understanding the world and God from the composite of the resources. My one final point. Most of you will say, we already do that. The critical point to remember is that sequence is very important. One should learn from history through whatever methodology is employed, what history can reveal about humans. Similarly, accept the meaning and values of your faith for what they are. Do not bias your examination of history with the facts of faith. And do not limit your faith with the biases of history. From these resources, work on your own theology. Answer those deep questions you have about life from the best of the resources at hand. It is at this point one likely will ask himself, given what I have learned and what I believe, how do I really see this whole situation? Where is my reality? What things have value to me? How do I want to live? What do I want to be, to believe? But remember these deliberations are separate and apart from and occur after the exercises in history and in faith that each have produced the facts for us to use. So I conclude the answer to faithful history lies not in a new methodology or formula, but rather in acknowledging that historians work with human evidences or facts. Believers work with divine evidences. Theologians try to put these two worlds of humans and God together. Good luck and thank you.
We have about 5 minutes for questions, if there are any.
Yes. I'd just like to make a comment. I might be very naive because I'm not a historian, but it seems to be like historians sort of take the attitude that because they have the evidence and then they thought it out and they put it together, whoever's going to read these books is going to believe them. I don't understand that you're that concerned, because who's ever going to read the book is going to take out of that book what they believe, what they want to accept. Now, like you mentioned, Joseph Smith's several visions. I like the historian that puts that all down on paper so that as I go through his book, I can read all the versions of the vision, and then his opinion, someone else's opinion, and then ultimately I make my own history, my own meaning. And I think that has to be done with religious history. And there's no way anybody here will read the same thing and come out with the same understanding. I don't think.
Yeah. I agree.
I think.
I wish you'd comment on that.
You want me to comment on that?
Yeah.
Well, to me, you illustrate exactly what the point I was trying to get at. In other words, the evidence, and I think what Bruce has indicated, that there is a tendency for the evidence to be stacked depending on what kind of philosophical or theological bias one brings into the process. And so. Reading Milton Backlund is different than reading Jan Shipps or reading Fawn Brody, and the same facts will come out. I mean, the access to the same facts, they'll come out differently. What I'm saying is those facts are simply historical. When you read it in the book, when you read the Bible, the record of the Old Testament, that's simply the words there are history. It's a record of past human activity. Any divinity that may occur or come out of the experience seems to me some way divinity, there has to be some communication with the divine. Even the Book of Mormon itself suggests when you read these things, you ask, and the witness comes from here, not from the words. So you're illustrating the process of reading those things, making up your own mind. You bring your own understanding, I bring a different understanding. We live in the world that is our own reality, and so you illustrate to me the kind of thing I was talking about.
Thank you.